Grief is the conversation that no one wants, but everyone will need at some point in their life. Losing my youngest son, Murray, in 2019, as he had just turned 22 years old, has been and is the single most challenging thing I have ever faced. And the guests on the Good Grief Conversation help me with that challenge every day, and they make the journey just that little bit easier. I hope that the open and honest conversation you will hear will help you too. Welcome to the Good Grief Conversation, here on UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Janet Jones. And welcome back to the Good Grief Conversation. Christmas is getting really close now. We're just a few days away. And today's guest is an author and a speaker, Rachel Kelly. Rachel and I have become friends over the last few years, so I also want to put Rachel in her professional category, just so that you can get to understand the quality of Rachel as a guest on the Good Grief Conversation. So I'm just going to read a little blurb from her website. It said, Rachel Kelly is a keynote speaker, best-selling writer, and mental health campaigner. She shares her experience of depression and evidence-based strategies that helped her recover. Rachel has spoken all over the world, from Delhi to Sydney, America, and across the UK, and her four critically acclaimed books are published in over 10 countries. Rachel is a well-known media commentator and former Times journalist. She is an official ambassador for mental health charities Rethink Mental Illness, SANE, and the Counselling Foundation, as well as Head Talks. So it's a great honour that Rachel is on the Good Grief Conversation today, and we speak quite openly about mental health and Christmas and loss at Christmas time, and come up with some really beautiful investigative conversation about how to make Christmas special. So it's my greatest pleasure to introduce my friend and author, Rachel Kelly. Rachel, thank you for joining me on the Good Grief Conversation. When we very first met, we did not expect to be sitting here now and having this kind of conversation.
I know. Well, it's lovely to be chatting to you again. And we have been in touch over such a dramatic change to your life, particularly, and I suppose everybody's lives, but it's been nice to be in touch over social media. But it's lovely to be talking to you live again. And as you say, under very different circumstances.
Yeah, not just for me, but for the whole world, isn't it? You know, I mean, the last time we were sat in a little cafe in London and chatting, and we couldn't stop chatting. And that was the first time we'd met as well, wasn't it? That, you know, we just hit it off.
Yes, it's really interesting, that, isn't it? Connection, because I suppose it's something that people are thinking a lot about at the moment, and where we find connection, and we long for connection. And it's not necessarily very obvious. You know, sometimes you can have a connection just with somebody you don't really know, but there's a match, and you know, you feel like you've known them for years, even though you've only just met them. And then other people who we assume we have a connection with, you know, we may or may not. So I think it's we're all looking for connection, and it's an odd time and where we find it at the moment.
And it's a very important thing as well, isn't it? Connection with other people. There's a lot of loneliness going on at the moment, you know.
I think so. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there is a profound loneliness, and that's a very serious thing. And we know it links to all sorts of other links to illness, it links to depression, it links to lots of really serious problems. But it's interesting because there is this also a kind of a sort of difference between loneliness and solitude. And I think that for some people, you know, everybody's experience has been just so different through this period. But I think for some people who maybe were overwhelmed and were on the rush and doing too much, you know, they have actually benefited from a sort of a positive loneliness, you might say, a kind of solitude and a kind of self-reflection. You know, just maybe that's a good way of looking at it, that yes, there is a very negative side there. And we can talk a little bit about ways, sort of strategies to sort of address that. But there may yet be a sort of little nugget of gold there. I think in my own personal life, I think I have enjoyed some of this time in terms of solitude and self-reflection, and just not always being dashing and just having that moment to pause and maybe reset a bit.
Yeah, I think the expectations have been reduced, haven't they? You know, so we're not having to fly around and look busy and look important. You know, now it's like, actually, you could just be, you have permission. Now, I know there's a lot of people who have really suffered financially and everything that, you know, let's not underestimate how difficult that is for business owners and people who've lost jobs and all kinds of stuff, which actually there's a lot of grief in that scenario as well, isn't there? You know, as life changes, drastically changes.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a sort of a sense of loss, and it isn't just, you know, what you might think of a sort of narrow definition of loss of bereavement and losing loved ones. But as you say, a loss of a future for our young people, that they had an expectation of a certain future. As you say, loss of jobs, a kind of loss of a certain life that we had. So that's a lot to process and take on board. But I think that I always remember, I'm Catholic, and I remember once talking to a Catholic priest about loss. My own mum died 2 years ago, just after we met, actually, which is a sort of big, big loss in my life. And I remember him saying, well, when you have loss and your hands are empty, there is space and you can receive something new as well. So I think that image of, you know, your hand holding up my hands now, and I do sometimes do that, that the sense that we have lost a lot, but maybe we can receive something new as well. And that may be a sort of more helpful way, perhaps, to thinking about it. Well, not to diminish, as you say, the pain. And I think there is also, I think, the second element, the sort of workshops that I've been running with some of my mental health charities, kind of how to kind of not just survive this period, but thrive, which is also that something just about accepting that pain. And not trying to sort of shut it down and just sort of allowing it and being in it. I think, you know, there's that idea, what we resist persists. So the more we sort of shut down that feeling of loss, that the more actually it's harder to sort of move on from it. So I think there's something there about just sort of allowing it. And I find some of the breathing exercises are really good, sort of allowing these difficult feelings and these feelings of loss, as I say.
And it's about, I guess, staying in the moment, you know, where the pain is, stay where the pain is. And I've had this conversation a few times, actually, and it's about leaning into the pain. And as you were saying, you know, the more you try not to see it or avoid it in some way, it's not going away. It isn't going to go away until you do lean in. And that's when you can receive.
And I think language is really important. This sort of the kind of dialogue we're having with ourselves. So if this sort of idea that our main relationship is always with ourselves, so our relationship with people around us is always really about more what's going on inside ourselves. And I think another thing that I found really helpful, you know, we've always needed it, but we need it now more than ever, is a kind of kindly dialogue. And language is really important. So as you say, that a sort of sense of leaning in, that's a lovely phrase, isn't it? A sort of gentleness to it. It's not a sort of force thing. It's just a sort of gentle lean. And the words that I like as well are just allow that feeling, allow that pain. I find the word allow is just so useful, sort of giving yourself permission rather than that our kind of British, you know, stiff upper lip, how are you? I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. You know, we don't allow ourselves that feeling. And I think that's a big shift in this whole conversation about mental health, is just allowing some of this. And I think sometimes it's a bit gendered as well. I think particularly men find it hard to allow a vulnerability, allow a sadness. You know, sometimes they say that in terms of depression, men not being able to acknowledge those difficult feelings, those loss, that can lead to depression. And sometimes they say it's gendered for women, then women won't allow themselves to be angry, you know, and they say sometimes depression is anger turned in, and it's not allowing that anger. And there probably is a bit of anger around as well at the moment, with combined with that loss, that we're feeling pretty cross as well. And women especially find it hard to sort of allow that.
Yeah. And that's quite normal where there's loss, where you feel angry. And I guess it's because suddenly feels like your security has been taken away. The expected life that you were having, and probably taking for granted because we don't always see the things that are closest to us, has been taken. And so we feel angry when something is taken from us. I think that's a really important thing, actually, to recognize during a grieving process, to allow that anger, you know, go and scream somewhere.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was sort of thinking a bit, you know, what does anger really mean? And I think you've nailed it in the sense that it's this idea that something gets taken away from you and you wanted it and it's not there and you're angry. It's like, it's almost like back to sort of children fighting over a toy. It's like, ah, that's mine. Oh, it's gone, you know, and you feel this sense of anger. But one of the sort of techniques that have been working, you know, running workshops and things, has been just seeing if things can show up maybe in a different way. So we may not have a future exactly as you say, how we envisaged it or planned it. Some of the things we want may show up rather differently. And I think that if we think of it like that, it's a sort of more peaceful kind of acceptance of our lack of knowing. And a point you made earlier that given the uncertainty and how hard we find to accept that uncertainty, you know, we're sapiens, you know, we like to plan, we like to think, we like to know what's happening. But coming back to just sort of being in the moment and seeing if we can just be more present-centered and be here and now and sort of focus on the immediate, you know, what's happening right here, right now. So like our conversation, like really being focused in on our experience, the two of us together right here, right now. And I think I find that a very good way to sort of diminish that feeling of fury, you know.
Yeah. And it takes practice as well, doesn't it? You know, to recognize. So when you are in those moments, practicing being in those moments. And so you don't need to worry about what you've just been doing or what you're about to do. Just be where you are. There's an old saying, isn't there? You know, when you're in the room, be in the room. And I think that's really key. There's another saying that just popped into my head, actually. And it's, I forget the author now. It's a little book called As Man Thinketh. You may have heard of that book. James somebody, he's an English guy, but like it's a 100-year-old thing. But in there, he says, you don't get what you want, you get what you need. So maybe when we're not getting what we want, we can go, I mustn't have needed that then. So what is it bringing me that I need?
I think that's a lovely idea. I mean, a few things coming up as you were talking. I mean, I love that thing, when you're in the room, get in the room. I do use quite a lot of the mindful technique, which are very helpful, I think. And one of them is when you're doing the washing up, you're doing the washing up. Being aware of the water, the senses, the colours, the light, the bubbles of the washing up liquid, just being really present to that experience and just being in that moment. And it's amazing how different it is when we do things with that kind of conscious awareness. So I think that, yeah, that being present centered. And also I love that idea that, you know, that what we, you know, maybe we're not sent what we want, but what we need. And I think both of us had painful bereavements. And I think that that sense of sort of psychological growth and learning, and that we're always learning. And we were chatting a bit earlier because we can't stop chatting, us.
We always get chatting straight away, I know.
Yeah. But that sense that, you know, we're not the person we were yesterday, we're not the person we will be tomorrow. But this is the only certainty, this kind of sense of learning and growth. And I find that a very, very comforting sort of notion. And this idea we're sent what we need. I'll give you a little example. So as you know, I'm a writer and mental health campaigner, but I've done a book which I've sent off to a lady agent, and she hasn't come back to me. And it's a good 4 or 5 weeks now. And so one of the things that I'm working on is looking for outside approval, and that I need somebody else to say what I've written is okay. And I want that sort of stamp of approval. And it's really interesting because I keep thinking every day, well, shall I call her and chase it up? And I was thinking, this is lovely growth actually for you, because what you really need is that we're all unique. You know, we've all got a voice. And for those of us that choose to want to write, we're just recording our voice and we're putting it out there. And it may be a match for some people. It may not be a match for other people. But we don't actually need anybody else to sort of tick a box and say, wow, that's okay. I'll be your agent. You know, you're all right now, Rachel, because I approve of you. So it's interesting how it seems like a rejection. Actually, that's sent to me, but as you say, something I need, because I actually need to work on wanting outside approval all the time, which is a real pattern of mine. And I've had it for years. You know, I'm only okay if someone ticks the box and says, yeah, you're good. You know, the only person who really can tell me that I'm okay is me. I'm sure you've got examples in your life as well, sort of sending things that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes down to really small things, like people who are in your life who maybe you don't see eye to eye with, and you think, oh, you know, they're upsetting you or annoying you or whatever. I've now started to look at that scenario as, this is something I need to learn. This is about me. Why am I getting annoyed? We're all unique. Why am I not respecting that other person's view of life and perspective? And when we all have our own perspectives, you know, it's like, so that's been a great lesson to me, to learn to just accept everybody as they are and stop trying to change people.
And then crucially, by accepting people as they are, you accept yourself as you are. So like, the less judgmental we are of others, then the less judgmental we are of ourselves. That is so weird, because I feel I'm on exactly the same bit of psychological learning myself at the moment. This idea, you know, coming back to yourself, and it's about our relationship with ourselves, and it's what is somebody else triggered? And I mean, I've been writing about this for a while. I wrote about it in my Walking on Sunshine book. I had this phrase, turn control into curiosity. So the idea is, like, instead of trying to control people around us, like being curious about ourselves, like, why are we trying to control them? You know, what is it? Because we're feeling anxious, so we're trying to kind of grip their behavior. And I think that's particularly relevant at the moment, when there's very little we can control of the big stuff. So we're kind of controlling all this little stuff. So I sort of knew it cognitively, turn control into, you know, curiosity. But I feel now it's a little bit more what you were saying. It's really much more of a feeling thing now, not so much a knowing thing, that I know that, you know, this is more about me, but it's actually really feeling it and actually feeling that it's okay. And it is okay, as you say, we're all different. Of course we are. There's 9 billion people on the planet and every single person's different. And actually, wouldn't it be boring if we were all the same? But I do think it's quite gendered again, that women particularly, you know, we're forever trying to agree with each other, aren't we? I mean, even you and I.
Yeah, but we're also of a similar mold. So we will tend to agree more, because we've traveled a similar path, haven't we?
I think that's true. And I think it's interesting. Maybe something's happening through this period, is that there's a sort of match of psychic energies when you're on a sort of similar place psychologically, because we're not able to be in a similar place. You know, we're going to the theatre together, or we're going to go out for a meal together. We've had to sort of match up with less, as it were. So it's kind of quite revealing whether you psychologically do fit with somebody or not.
It's true, because we're now starting to connect on that deeper level, aren't we? Because we haven't got all those frills going on the outside. And I think that's what loss does for you. You know, it strips away the layers on the outside that we have created, we have built up. Whereas in loss, you know, you get ripped down to the core. I'm sure you experienced this with losing your mom. You know, it opens you up somehow. And I think it also takes you onto a higher level of view on life. Like the first image in my book is this rock climbing image, ironically. And so if you think about, you know, as you get older and as things happen to you, the more challenging, because as you climb higher, it becomes more challenging. And as you get through life, you know, we are given times in our lives that are challenging. But as we accomplish and grow through those, and I don't mean accomplish as in a big career accomplishment, a personal, as we grow through those things, the view it's clearer. Does that make sense? It feels like you're higher up spiritually somehow.
No, I know what you mean. I think when you were just talking, I had this image of an onion, sort of, you know, peeling back the layers of the onion. And I think that in my life, that when I think of sort of peeling back the layers, there are a lot of them are the stories that I told myself or assumptions that I made. You know, as one sort of questions those stories or questions those assumptions or just sort of allows a kind of, as you say, a kind of like a new reality, it is as once for a sort of vulnerability there because you haven't got your layers that you've sort of built up protecting yourself. And especially not just sort of psychological layers, but also success in a worldly sense or money or status or all the things that we perceive as in a Western society as markers of, you know, you're okay. And when they get stripped back with, you know, setbacks or, as I say, kind of questioning some of them, it is quite frightening on one level. But then on another level, I do think it's very liberating. And you do meet people. I mean, even since we met face to face and then obviously stayed in touch, but I mean, I'm feeling it now. I'm going a bit goosebumpy, but I feel we are meeting at a different level, at a deeper level. You know, we just, there's less sort of surface stories, you know, and I do feel more and more that a lot of this is about our sort of embodied feeling more than our heads. And this is why I don't know if you can see, but I literally am going goosebumpy. I sometimes get this when I read a really powerful poem. Because I think a poem as well just takes you to that deeper level of pure feeling, pure awareness, unencumbered by kind of expectations or society's expectations or our own expectations, our family's expectations. And we're back to a very powerful inner core, really, of what we really feel about things.
Yeah, I agree. Like you say, moving from the head into the more heart-centered and, you know, living from sort of the center of our being, as opposed to in the head where we're always trying to control the outcome. Certainly losing Murray, I realized there is no control of the outcome. You know, you very much are in the place of what is. That was also a massive lesson to learn to be in the space of what is. You know, like at the moment, I'm trying to sell my house and there's a part of me that's going, oh, well, if I could just sell the house, I'll be able to do this and I'll be able to do that. But until somebody comes and buys it, I am not in control of that. So again, it's a really big lesson of learning to be in the space of what is.
I found it's really transformed my anxiety levels to not let go of outcomes, you know, let go of fixed outcomes and just what can we really control? We sometimes take it very personally. We think, you know, well, if they don't buy my house, they don't like me. You know, it's a sort of somehow a... Who's to say the myriad cards and not even the cards we know about, the known unknowns, but the unknown unknowns, you know, that whole idea. What do we really know of all this, how things will pan out? And I think letting go of needing to know and needing to know the outcome. And we've got lots of uncertainty. You know, every family's got so many uncertainties at the moment. You know, my husband's job is very uncertain, you know, whether we're going to move house like you. There's lots of aspects of our life right now and same for everybody. But I come back as well to if you want to get to be more in that, not attached to fixed outcomes, you have to come back to being allowing of the feelings. And I think that that's probably the nub of it, that a lot of us are frightened of those feelings. We built a lifetime of keeping away from feelings because they're quite scary. And it's easier to live in our heads and, you know, to tick things off and make plans and et cetera, et cetera. But I know myself that I do resist feeling because it's scary.
But it's vulnerable, isn't it? You know, you are truly revealing yourself. This Christmas that's coming, everyone is so used to big decorations and big families. And the truth is, those Christmases usually result for many people in big family fallouts. But yet we paint this external image that everything is wonderful. Whereas when we strip all that away, which this Christmas has been stripped away for many, many people for many reasons, then you have the core. And then, which is what you and I were talking about at the beginning when we were talking about Christmas, and I'm like, I don't really know what this Christmas now looks like, not only because of COVID, but because of Murray. And so suddenly it's like, what does it look like? And the way to deal with that is, okay, now what's important to you? And I think that's the key, isn't it? build it around what's important to you.
Well, I was going to say, I think there is something exciting as well about, you know, lining up with what works for you. And the problem with the narrative, the story, the expectation that we need a big Christmas and we need our tree and we all have to play happy families, et cetera, is that, you know, maybe that is right for you. That's okay. You know, it's a bit like the debate about academic pressure on children at school. Maybe your child is going to be a nuclear scientist or an academic or a philosopher or a professor. By all means, support their academic endeavor, but that may or may not be true for another child. And I think it's a bit like that with Christmas. It's like, it may be the right thing to do the big festive thing, but actually, again, if you can come back to yourself and try and line up, what would you actually really like? What might line up with you might be to go for a long hike all day, or even just, there's a million options, isn't there, about what would Christmas really be joyful for you? I mean, it could just be that you'd love to be hang out with your friends. A lot of people, their friends are their family. It's just being really in tune and aware about what does line up with you. And actually, that's not selfish. I think this is another big bit of learning for me in the last couple of years, is this idea that there's such a sort of strong narrative about, you know, it's selfish to sort of do what you want, basically. But how about the idea that it's actually really liberating for other people, is that really the best way to make them happy is to line up with what's right for you and to allow them to line up with what's right for them. And a little bit back to what you were saying, allowing for difference and being tolerant of that. You know, we're not all the same. We don't all want the same Christmas.
Absolutely not. You know, so to ask people, what do they actually want for Christmas? Take away the pressure and just say, what do you want? Right. So is it that you want to put on your reindeer ears for walking in the hills, you know, and general chit chat with people, and maybe take a little, I don't know, bottle of wine in your backpack, or, you know, just be your own creator, I think is the key. We can now put away those Christmas expectations.
Yeah. And I think also, there's something about the idea that we are responsible for ourselves and our own happiness, but we cannot take responsibility for everybody else's happiness. And I sometimes think it's almost, you know, especially parents, it's gone too far that we can, you know, sort our children and make them happy. And I think there's something really liberating about a feeling of empowerment and, you know, agency. And I think sometimes in the mental health world, and I'm no disrespect to medication, and I've used much of it over the years and can be a lifesaver, but I do think as well that if I look at my own history of anxiety and depression, one of the things that's helped is this sense of a little bit of agency, responsibility. What are the things that I could do as well to look after myself or to be happy? And, you know, we can extend that to Christmas Day, you know, a little bit of responsibility. Look, you know, I don't need anybody else to make me happy. I can decide that, you know, this is what I'd like to do to feel happy. And that's a lovely gift for other people. It's not selfish.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that is a great way of looking at it, is that I am responsible for my own happiness. When people get that, then we can stop putting pressure on people to get them to make me happy. Real happiness is not about that. You know, real happiness is not about always leaping about in the street with a big smile on your face. You know, I have discovered that you can be both happy and sad in the same moment, which is was a real eye-opener to me. There were times in the early stages and I would think, you know, well, am I depressed? Am I sick with this grief? And I would check in with myself and I'd think, no, I am extremely sad, but I'm not specifically unhappy. That was a revelation for me.
And I think maybe, again, language is important here, because the difference was sort of, I am sad or I feel sad. And actually we have these strong emotions, but they are passing. And we can be consumed by terrible sadness that descends, but then it passes. And then, you know, we can also feel that joy. And I think the way I like to think of it these days is I sort of feel that there's a kind of pure awareness. There's a sort of state when we feel connected to ourselves and we feel in the moment, we feel present, we feel allowing, all the things in a way we've been talking about. And then we can get out of whack. We, you know, we can feel out of kilter. We can feel angry. We can feel sad. We can't not have these emotions. They're part of being human. But then, you know, we can kind of come back to feeling back in alignment again. But it's a sort of fluidity between the states rather than I am this or I am that. Actually, I'm somebody who's constantly changing, and it's a sort of fluidity that I like at the moment.
Yeah. But isn't that life though, Rachel, that actually life is fluid and there's so much pressure on making life always happy, and real happiness actually comes from knowing that life is fluid. It's like the weather, you know, there will be dark days, there will be slightly overcast days, there will be gloriously blue sky days. Even in the darkest of times, it always lifts.
Yes. That's so funny because, in fact, one of the books I've been working on is using poetry to sort of access emotions, but using the device of the seasons. So the sort of the winter of our discontent to the summer of love. And exactly as you say, nature is a wonderful model for us. It isn't sunny all the time. Of course it isn't. It's not possible for it to be. I think I'm a little bit guilty myself of writing books with happiness in the title. I think given that we're always changing, I think I would have a more fluid approach now.
Yeah. Maybe we write a joint book. I'm guilty of that also. You know, like my book, Happiness Millionaire, it does set people up to say, oh, well, if I read this book, I can be happy all the time. Now, within its pages, I'm fairly honest, actually. But I think the truth is that happiness, it is part of everything, just like nature is there to be part of everything. And it moves, it goes up and down, it's windy, it's this, it is energetic, and it moves all the time and blows around. And that's what we are. We are emotional beings, and emotions are not a static thing.
No, I agree with that. I think, in a way, my first book, Black Rainbow, which was more about experiences of severe depression and going into hospital, in some ways that was more honest about this sort of more fluidity. And I use that image of a rainbow because, you know, without the rain and the sun together, we don't get a rainbow. So the sort of the eyes that do not cry are the saddest eyes of all. So we need that. We need that sort of texture of different feelings. But I suppose in my own journey, I then became very focused on sort of strategies that would help to sort of get you off the floor. And it's almost like I've sort of come through that own curve myself to now feeling so much better and calmer and happier that it's almost now I can acknowledge that it's almost I went too far the other way. You know, that kind of theory that you like with social change, sometimes we have to overemphasize the problem to get to a sort of more normal position. So it's almost like I've done a lot of work on strategies for well-being and happiness. And only now can I sort of say, actually, you know what? It's not going to happen all the time.
No. And it is important to have, you know, strategies and ways to handle those dark times. I can honestly say, had I not had the experience I had before losing Murray, if I hadn't have been doing that work, I wouldn't be here right now. I would physically be here more than likely, but who knows? There were some really dark times that the thought of living was too great. But because of having the tools and the strategies and understanding the importance of open and honest conversation, then I was able to get up and realizing that this isn't going to happen overnight, but you have to stay in the game. You know, I remember like my dad in 1994, he took his own life. And I always think if only he had got up another day. And so in my dark times, that's what I used to say to myself, just get up another day. You don't have to think about next week, but you just get up in the morning. And that's all you need to do at that moment in time, then the clouds will go, you know, and you'll get stronger and you'll be able to move the clouds away with the strategies that you and I talk about and promote.
No, it's really interesting because, you know, I was kind of incredibly close to my mom and I would talk to her every day, and she lives, you see, she's
still does live,
even using the present. she lives across the road, and you know, she died in my arms, and a lot of people around me and my family were really worried because my major depressions were triggered by these kind of quite big life events. And we know that people are vulnerable bereavement to depression or childbirth or big hormonal changes, so sort of menopausal women or adolescents. And they were sort of slightly hovering in the aftermath of her death because they thought, well, we're, you know, Rachel might go down, especially with insomnia, which is often a big trigger for me. And I didn't. And, you know, I think a little bit like you, I did have some tools. And actually, it's quite a good point, really, that sometimes, you know, especially working with schools now, I do go into schools a bit. You can see some of the young people thinking, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with my life. Why do I need all this stuff? You know, why do I want these breathing techniques or knowing about how to maximize your well-being with nutrition and stuff? And I think, well, actually, tuck them in your toolbox now. And then, you know, you haven't really got time to learn them when there's the big crisis. And who's to say when that's coming? It's going to happen to all of us. So it's quite a nice thing to sort of, Scout's motto, be prepared. But that's one of the reasons I'd love to get some of this work into schools. And it is happening. You know, I think there's a big recognition now that, you know, we know most mental health problems do at least probably a quarter of them present before age 18. So let's get this stuff in early. Maybe people will be able to handle with, you know, much, much greater ease, you know, the dramas that are inevitable in all our lives.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's what I say to people, you know, learn now before the drama comes, because like you've just said, it will come. If you live long enough, life has its challenges. It is the way that life is. You just touched on the nutrition there, and I realized we're nearly done with our conversation. And I said to you, I wanted to talk about your Happiness Kitchen book.
Here it is. Yeah. So it was part of this journey that we've been chatting about and trying to build up the toolkit. I saw my GP about 4 or 5 years ago, and she said, how are you getting on? And I said, well, I've done my mindfulness, and you know, there's obviously medication, and I've done my therapy, and et cetera, et cetera. And she wrote on a prescription pad as I was leaving, happy foods. And she wrote down three. She said, oily fish, dark green leafy vegetables, and dark chocolate. And it was the first time someone had directly linked nutrition with mental health. And I was really riveted because I didn't even know it was a topic. And I thought, well, that's nice, chocolate, you know, dark chocolate. Anyway, it led to a long journey working with this beautiful lady, Alice McIntosh. We looked at the symptoms of sort of low mood and anxiety and you know, what were the nutritional interventions in each one? So we tried to be positive. So we said, you know, what would you have to eat for balanced energy, beating the blues, being nice and calm, mental clarity, hormonal peace, sweet dreams, because I'd always had a problem with insomnia. Comfort food, you know, a lot of us, especially recently, we know we turn to food for comfort. Is there a way of sort of reframing that? So, yeah, it's been a very happy journey. And I think it's something that people have found a little bit helpful through this period, judging I've had quite a few nice bits of feedback. It may not have been something people have thought of. And, you know, they're at home, they're cooking at home, they're not going out. Is this something you could add to your toolkit?
Definitely. Rachel, would you come back in the new year and we can go deeper into your habit if we get past our chit chat?
Well, that would be lovely. Yes. I mean, I think it references a lot of our ideas in the sense that it's about agency, it's about empowerment. It's a lot of the things that I found really helpful. And I think people's conversation with food is sometimes quite complicated. So if you can, again, we've talked about that gentler dialogue and a different vocabulary. And that's something that's changed as well a lot for me. So no, I'd love to chat more.
I think that would be really great. You know how much I love your book as well. But so I think, yeah, we can do that in the new year. Yeah. But for now, you know, our time is done here, Rachel. I think we've covered some really great ground and talked about, like, you know, Christmas coming up and general when we have losses and things and finding that state of happiness and health and well-being. So brilliant. Thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing.
You've made my day. So thank you.
Thanks a lot, Rachel. I'll speak to you soon.
All right. Wonderful. Thanks, Janet.
You're welcome. Well, there you go. Another great conversation that really has wrapped up our Christmas season, excuse the pun. And I think it's wrapped it up very nicely. And that was a really great conversation. We went deep once again on the happiness, grief, loss, Christmas, all those kind of things that, you know, were set to challenge us, but challenges are not a bad thing, really. And, you know, look, if you're in the thick of a challenge, you have my love. love and consideration and compassion, and just know that you will come through the dark spaces and into being a different person, just as Rachel and I were discussing in that conversation. So I hope that you got something really fulfilling out of that, and something that will help you with your grief journey and your life journey into 2021, where we're all going to be different. You know, life has created many changes for all of us. What I'm going to do is, and the original conversation that Rachel and I had when we met in the cafe in London, I'm going to put that interview into the podcast extras, because I've re-listened to it and there's some really valuable information. And we actually talk about Rachel's cookery book in that conversation. Now, Rachel will come back in the new year and we'll dive deeper into her Happiness Kitchen cookery book. But if you would like a copy of that, I'm also going to put that link into the podcast extras also. So to get all of that, just go to www.thegoodgriefconversation.com and just sign up for the podcast extras, where you will get the opportunity to support these podcasts, and that is always gratefully received. And they help us, you know, your contribution helps us to get this conversation to a wider audience and to really grow and develop this conversation that is still quite taboo. We're going to change that with the guests that I have on this show. You know, everyone is passionate about changing the taboo subject around grief and leaving people alone to handle and work out what grief means to them. You know, here we'd like to have this really open, honest, and supportive conversation. So do join us on podcast extras. And like I say, we really do appreciate your support. If you would like to find out more about Rachel and connect with Rachel, then her website is www.rachel-kelly.net. That's rachel-kelly.net, and you'll find everything that you need over there. So in the meantime, fabulous to speak with you in the run-up to Christmas, as always, and I wish you a very festive and joyful season. And I will speak to you next week. I have just a monologue of my own next week for in between Christmas and New Year. And then we'll be back in the new year with more inspiring guests to help us along the journey of grief and transition. In the meantime, you take care, and I will speak to you very soon. Bye for now.